Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam.
Canto 10, Chapter 61, Chapter entitled Lord Balaram Slays Rukmi, Text Number 26.
Tasmin
Abhyudaye
Rajan
Rukmini
Ramakeshavo Puram
Bojakatam Jagmu Samba Prajumna Kadaya.
Tasmin Abhyudaye Rajan
Rukmini Ramakeshavo Purambojakatam Jagmu
Samba Prajumna Kadaya
Tasmin On the occasion of that Abhyudaye Happy event
Rajan
O King
Rukmini
Ramakeshavo Balaram and Krishna Puram
To the city
Bojakatam
Jagmu
Went. Samba Prajumna Kadaya Samba Prajumna and others. Translation and purports by the followers of Srila Prabhupada. On the joyous occasion of that marriage, O King, Queen, Rukmini, Lord Balaram, Lord Krishna, and several of the Lord's sons, headed by Samba and Prajumna, went to the city of Bojakata. Translation response. On the joyous occasion of that marriage, O King,
Queen Rukmini,
Lord Balaram,
Lord Krishna,
and several of the Lord's sons,
headed by Samba and Prajumna,
went to the city of Bojakata. Text 27-28. After the wedding, a group of arrogant kings, headed by the king of Kalinga, told Rukmi, "You should defeat Balaram at dice. He's not expert at dice, O King, but still he's quite addicted to it." Thus advised, Rukmi challenged Balaram and began a gambling match with him. Text 29. In that match, Lord Balaram first accepted a wager of 100 coins, then 1,000, then 10,000. Rukmi won this first round, and the king of Kalinga laughed loudly at Lord Balaram, showing all his teeth. Lord Balaram could not tolerate this. Purport. Srila Vishnu Chakravarti explains that the wages consisted of gold coins. Lord Balaram inwardly became quite angry when he saw the gross offence of the king of Kalinga. Omagyan Timarandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militam Jena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadati Swa Padantikam Vancha Kalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhupya Evacha Petitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavibhyo namo namaha. Jai Shri Krishna, Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda, Shri Advaita Gadadhara, Shri Vasadi Gaura, Bhaktivinoda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So we see here that Rukmi has been advised by his friends to challenge Lord Balaram to a gambling match of dice. Now, the friends of Rukmi, the other princes, the other kings, they have advised that Lord Balaram is not very good at playing dice. So this was their first mistake. Because if you think that the Supreme Lord is not good at anything, then that is called Maya, or that which is not. Because Krishna is the best at everything. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, of cheetahs, I am... What does he say? Has anyone heard of the Bhagavad Gita before? Of cheaters, I am the greatest cheat. No? Krishna says that in the Bhagavad Gita. Right? If you think you can cheat Krishna, what will happen to you? You will meet your match and beyond. Krishna has already cheated you before you can even think that you are going to cheat him. Right? Krishna knows everything, past, present and future. So how can you defeat him in anything, in any way? So, Lord Balaram is Krishna's first expansion. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, it is taught, Ete Chamsa, Kalapumsa. Amsa means a part. Ete Chamsa, Kalapumsa. There are many parts of Godhead, right? Many expansions of Godhead, many incarnations of Godhead. It says in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the third chapter of the first canto, there are more incarnations of Godhead than there are waves on the ocean. So even if you go just out there to Port Phillip Bay and you count all the waves that are there, there are more incarnations of Krishna than that. What to speak of all the oceans in the universe, all the oceans in every universe. So there are unlimited incarnations. But the Srimad Bhagavatam says, Krishna's tu and Bhagavan swayam. Tu means but. There are unlimited incarnations of God, but Krishna is Swayam Bhagavan, means the original personality of Godhead himself. This is the conclusion of Srila Vyasadeva. This is the conclusion of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So this is the correct Siddhanta. Not everyone understands this point. Even if you go to India, then you'll see there are so many different philosophical speculations and understandings that no one practically understands anything anymore. Just like you meet most people from India, right? And you say, this is the Bhagavad Gita. And they say, I know, I know. I know. I am knowing Bhagavad Gita. I am knowing everything. You don't have to tell me anything. Hare Krishna. Right? I know it. I know. What do you know of the Bhagavad Gita? Just like when most people, they say, I know the Bhagavad Gita. And you say to them, what do you know of the Bhagavad Gita? They say, well, my grandmother had it on the shelf. Right? So what does that mean? Right? Just because your grandmother had it on the shelf, right? And suddenly you know the Bhagavad Gita. Right? Even sometimes people, when you're preaching to them, they say, I know the Bhagavad Gita. Or they say, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita. And I remember around about Christmas time, just gone, around about New Year's time, I went to stay with some congregational member of our congregation, ISKCON congregation. I went to stay with them. And I was speaking to them. And the wife, the Mataji, she was saying to me, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, and she said, I can't remember what she said, and she said, Krishna says this. And I said, where does Krishna say that in the Bhagavad Gita? Because I've studied the Bhagavad Gita and I don't remember seeing that in the 700 verses. So I was saying, where is that in the Bhagavad Gita? So people say all these kind of things. This is called mental speculation. Right? You can just say whatever you want and you say, well, Krishna said it. Right? In the Bhagavad Gita. Or you can just speculate and have any philosophy you want, basically. And if you go to India, basically you'll see there are unlimited philosophies. Right? People will say this and they will say that. There's unlimited different understandings. But what is this Siddhanta? What is the truth? What is the actual conclusion? Right? People say, oh, in the Vedas it says this, and in the Bhagavatam it says that, and in the Gita it says this. They say so many different things. But the first point we need to make to people, when I'm preaching to people, the first point I say is, who wrote the book? Who wrote the Vedas? Just like on Saturday night, I was driving back after the Bhakti Vaibhav course, I was driving back to Yogesh's place, and his wife's cousin has just come to Australia, and she was sitting in the back seat, and she's a devotee of Lord Shiva. So I was preaching to her. So I'm trying to get her to understand that Krishna is Tu Bhagavan Swayam, that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So in order to try to convince her that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, I gave her the Krishna book. And in the Krishna book, near the end of the Krishna book, near the end of the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam, which we're coming up to, near the end of the Krishna book, chapters 83 and 84, these are two very good chapters if you're preaching to someone who is confused about who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because these chapters compare Krishna to Shiva, like that. Bhrigu Muni is sent by the other sages to discover who is the Supreme Lord. So he travels, right? And first he goes to Brahma, then he goes to Shiva, and then he goes to Vishnu. And he concludes out of the three personalities, he concludes that Vishnu is the Supreme. So this is the conclusion. So I was speaking to this Mataji, and she was saying to me that Shiva is actually supreme, like that. And then I said, well, if Shiva is supreme, then where is that found in the Vedas? Right? And she says, oh, well, there is some comment. There is Shiva Purana and there is different Puranas and like that. And in some comments, in some parts of the Vedas, it even says that Vishnu worships Shiva. Right? There are even statements like that. So then her conclusion was, if Vishnu is worshipping Shiva, then Shiva must be supreme. So then I said to her, then who wrote the Vedas? And she said to me, Krishna. Right? So this is the situation. You know, many people in India, they don't even know who wrote the Vedas, or they don't even know what the proper conclusion of the Vedas are. There's just so many different speculations, there's so many different beliefs, there's so many different understandings, but no one actually knows. So she said to me that Krishna wrote the Vedas, and I said, did Krishna actually write the Vedas, did he? Right? Where does it say that Krishna wrote the Vedas? Right? No, Vyasa wrote the Vedas. Or if you get very, very technical, actually Ganesh wrote the Vedas. You know, Vyasa spoke, and Ganesh was the scribe of Srila Vyasadeva. Ganesh has four arms, so Vyasadeva was speaking, and Ganesh was writing everything down, and when two of his arms got tired, then he would swap arms, and then he would keep writing. So he wrote for days and days and days, and they wrote all the Vedas down, right, at the beginning of Kali Yuga. So then, if we are to understand who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then you have to go to the ultimate authority of the Vedas. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Vedantakrit, Vedavid, Aham, Eva, Vejo, I am to be known. Right? By all the Vedas, I am to be known. And Krishna says, Vedantakrit, which means I am the compiler of the Vedas. How did Krishna compile the Vedas? In his form of Srila Vyasadeva. So Srila Vyasa has written all the Vedas down. So he wrote the Vedas, and if we want to go to his, if we want to study the chronology or the history of how the Vedas became manifest, Then you go to the Srimad Bhagavatam, the Bhagavat Purana, and it describes the history of how Srila Vyasadeva wrote the Vedas. So he wrote all the Vedas, he wrote his commentary on the Vedas, the Vedanta Sutra, he wrote all the Puranas, he wrote the fifth Veda, the Mahabharata, right, the Ramayana, everything was complete. And then you'll see that his guru came. Right? Who was the guru of Vyas?
Narada.
Right? People don't even know this. Right? They say, oh, Krishna wrote the Vedas. Right? And you say, no, Krishna didn't write the Vedas, Vyas wrote the Vedas. Right? Who is Vyasa's guru? Right? People don't actually think about the actual situation or the reality. What is the use of claiming to be an authority on anything if you're not an authority on it? Just like Prabhupada gives the example, what is the use of going to someone who is a brain surgeon if they haven't studied brain surgery? Just like you go and you meet someone who read a book, you know, got a book from the library about brain surgery, and you say, well, I've got a headache. And he says, that's okay, because I've read a book on brain surgery, I'll fix you up. Right? I know the situation. Right? If I cut your head right here, I can fix your brain. Right? I know how to do it. I know all the system like that. But the person is not an authority. So you don't trust the person as not an authority. So people are so ignorant in the age of Kali especially that they say, yes, I know the Vedas, I know the Bhagavad Gita, I know Krishna, I know everything. Right? But they haven't gone any further. They probably never even picked up the Bhagavad Gita. You know, just the fact that their grandmother had it on their shelf when they were a kid, and suddenly they became the authority on Bhagavad Gita. Right? This is the situation. So we see that Vyas, he completed all the Vedas, but then at the end of completing all the Vedas, what was the situation? He felt incomplete. Right? This is described in the Srimad Bhagavatam. He felt dissatisfied. Right? Just like when you look at someone's face, immediately you can tell what is going on in the mind. Right? This person is peaceful, this person is happy, this person is distressed, this person is confused. As soon as you look at the face, Prabhupada said it is the index of the mind. So Narada came to Vyas, and just by looking at his face he could understand he was dissatisfied. And he said, why are you dissatisfied? You've just completed all the Vedas. You've written Vedanta Sutra. You've compiled all the histories. Right? Everything is there. So why are you feeling dissatisfied? So then he suggested to his disciple, he said, could it be that you have not exclusively written a scripture which discusses pure devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna without any other mixture or contamination of anything else? Just like Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Nishtraigunyo Bhavajuna. He said the Vedas mainly deal with the subject matter of the three modes of material nature. Right? Most of the Vedas are contaminated by the three modes of material nature. Just like there are 18 Puranas, minor Puranas, and 18 major Puranas. Six are in the mode of goodness, six are in the mode of passion, six are in the mode of ignorance. Right? So the Vedas mainly deal with the subject matter of the three modes of material nature. They're very much heavily to do with stories and personalities and reactions by personalities who are very much affected by the modes of nature. So he said, write one book which is transcendental. Right? Write one book which is beyond the modes of material nature, which is not primarily dealing with the modes of nature, but is dealing with the transcendental situation of Shuddha Sattva. So then Srila Vyasadeva compiled the Srimad Bhagavatam. So therefore Srimad Bhagavatam is considered to be the final authority of all of the Vedic literatures. So those who understand the Srimad Bhagavatam, they understand the absolute truth to its most perfect and highest matter. So as we're saying in the beginning, if you go to India, there are many people who do not understand what is the proper siddhanta, what is the proper tattva, what is the proper purpose of the Vedas. They don't understand what is the conclusion of the Vedas. And then even amongst Vaishnavas, different groups of devotees, not all of the Vaishnavas understand the final conclusion of the Vedas themselves. Just like if you go to South India and you'll speak to the Sri Vaishnavas, No, who are Vaishnavas, they're devotees of the Lord. Right? They're not Mayavadis, they're not non-devotees, they're not Karmakandis, they're not anything else, they're devotees. But they do not understand this point, Krishna stu Bhagavan Swayam. They don't understand that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They think that Lord Narayan is the Supreme Personality of Godhead and Krishna is his expansion. But this is not Srila Vyasadeva's final conclusion. Right? That is not the final point that Vyasadeva made in the Srimad Bhagavatam. In the Bhagavatam he concluded finally, Krishna stu Bhagavan Swayam. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this is the correct understanding. This is the correct conclusion of the Vedas. Now, we see here that in this chapter, chapter 61, that Rukmi is dealing with Lord Balaram, and Lord Balaram is Krishna's first expansion. Right? So he's practically on the level of Krishna. He's practically as powerful as Krishna in every respect. Practically as powerful as Krishna. But still it is said that Krishna is the original, or the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It is said that practically the only difference between Lord Balaram and Lord Krishna is the colour of their form. Right? One is blackish, one is whitish. But in terms of potency, they're practically equal in every respect. Even we see that Rupa Goswami describes that there are four characteristics which separates Krishna from his other incarnations. Right? What are the four characteristics which separate Krishna from all of his other incarnations, Lord Narayan and all the different incarnations which are there? Yes, sir?
If you kill someone with a liberator?
That's not one of the four, no. That's just previous to that. Lord Narayan also has those qualities. But there's four qualities that Krishna has that even Narayan does not have.
Youthful and all offences.
Say it again.
Youthful and all offences. Youthful and all offences.
Yeah, that's it. But that's not one of the four characteristics. Yeah, Madhurya, Venu Madhurya means the sweetness of his flute playing. Yeah. Right, like that.
His Leela?
Yeah, that's called Leela Madhurya, the sweetness of his pastimes. That's good. Two more?
Devotees?
Yeah, that's called Prema Madhurya. That means the love of his devotees is different to the love of the devotees of Lord Narayan. It is more sweet. And one more? Rupa Madhurya, yeah, means the sweetness of his form. His form is all attractive. Krishna's form is even so attractive it even attracts Lord Narayan. Right? Even Narayan is attracted. Even Krishna in Dwarka is attracted to his original Vrindavan form. Right? His original form of Shama Sundara. That is the Rupa, that is the sweetest of all the forms. In Dwarka, there is pastimes described by the Goswamis that sometimes Krishna in the Sudama assembly hall in the morning, before they begin the day, before they begin all the proceedings of the day in managing the affairs of the state, all the Yadus gather together in the morning, then sometimes they have some dramas and things like that to lighten the mood and to get everyone in a very pleasant mood in the morning. So then one morning there was a drama, and the drama depicted, one actor came on and he depicted Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan. When Krishna was a cowherd boy. And when Krishna in Dwarka, right, saw Krishna in Vrindavan, saw himself in Vrindavan, he became enchanted by the Vrindavan Krishna. Right? And then he went into the mood of the Vrindavan Krishna and he desired to go back to Vrindavan. So even Krishna in Dwarka, even Lord Narayan, even God himself is attracted to his original form. Right? That is the most attractive of all the forms. Right? So these four qualities that Lord Balaram has, that Krishna has, the four qualities that Krishna had, Lord Balaram also possesses them. He is the only other one who possesses them. All the other incarnations do not have these four qualities developed the same as Krishna does. But Balaram also has these qualities. Venu Madhurya means the sweetness of Krishna's flute playing. Now, it's not that Lord Narayan does not know how to play a flute. It's not that Lord Narayan in Vaikuntha doesn't know how to play a flute, right? If he didn't know how to play a flute, he would not be very powerful like that. We say Lord Narayan is God, you know. So we say that Krishna plays the flute. It's not that Lord Narayan can't play a flute, but he can't play it like Krishna. Right? The way Krishna plays a flute is so sweet, right? So carefree, right? He plays in such a sweet, in the Vrindavan atmosphere, the way Krishna plays the flute is so attractive that it surpasses even the flute playing of Lord Narayan. And Lord Balaram can also play his flute like this, like that. And then, Leela Madhurya means the sweetness of Krishna's pastimes. Why is it that Krishna's Vrindavan pastimes are considered to be the sweetest? Why are they sweeter than the pastimes in Dwarka, or the sweeter than the pastimes in Vaikuntha? Yeah, they're not spoiled by all of it. Yeah, that's true. But there's another element there also.
More intimate.
They're more intimate, that's true. But there's another.
Parakriya-rasa?
Yeah, Parakriya-rasa. Yeah, ultimately that's true. That's true. Yeah. There's another reason why these pastimes consider sweeter in Vrindavan.
Prema.
Yeah.
The prema?
Yeah. Yeah, the love is there. The love is sweeter. Because Krishna is a child. Right? And the pastimes of children are more sweet than pastimes of adults. Like that. Right? Krishna is up until the age of 16 in Vrindavan. He doesn't go beyond 16 in Vrindavan. So the pastimes at that time are more sweet, because you won't see that when Krishna leaves Vrindavan, he's past 16. Right? So then when he goes to Dwarka or he goes to Mathura, then he's lost that youthful, those youthful pastimes have been lost. And you'll see that in Vaikuntha, Lord Narayan's pastimes are never displayed on that level of being a youth or being like a young person. Right? He's already Navayovana, which means he's already a youth. He's already like 20, 25. He's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He never gets old, but he doesn't have childhood pastimes. Right? You never hear about Lord Narayan having a mother or a father. Right? But in Vrindavan, Krishna has Mother Yashoda and Nanda Maharaj. So therefore he has pastimes with his parents, which are very sweet. Right? But those pastimes are not found in Vaikuntha. All those pastimes are not found in Dwarka. So the sweetness of his pastimes in Vrindavan, Lord Balaram also has those pastimes. Right? The Prema Madhurya means the love of Krishna's devotees for Krishna in Vrindavan surpasses the love in any of the other dharms in Dwarka or in Vaikuntha. Lord Balaram also has this love. And Rupa Madhurya means the sweetness of his form, right? His beauty, right? Which is all attractive in Vrindavan. Lord Balaram also has this. So Balaram is practically on the same level as Krishna. But we see he is Krishna's first expansion. He is not the original personality of Godhead. And we see in the 13th chapter of the 10th canto, then we see that pastime which shows that even Lord Balaram can become bewildered by Krishna. What was the pastime where even Lord Balaram became bewildered by Krishna? Yeah, Brahma Vimohana Lila. Right? We see that Lord Brahma stole all of the cowherd boys and all of the cows for 1 year. So for 1 year, who was the cows and who was the cowherd boys?
Krishna
himself expanded. So then all the residents of Vrindavan had the same love for all the cows. All the cows had the same love for their calves. And all of the mothers and fathers in Vrindavan had the same love for their children as they normally would just have for Krishna. So after 1 year, about 3 days before the year finished, then Lord Balaram noticed that this is not ordinary. Right, there's something going on here. Right? Why is it that they're as attracted to the cows are attracted to the calves the same way they're normally attracted to Krishna? Why is it the mothers and fathers in Vrindavan are attracted to the cowherd boys, their children, as much as they normally are attracted to Krishna? So then Lord Balaram began to think this could only be happening if Krishna is displaying his yogamaya potency. So then Lord Balaram said to Krishna, he said, "Are you doing something? Right? Is there something going on that even I don't know about? Because I know everything. Right? There's nothing I don't know. I know everything. I'm Balaram. Like I'm your first expansion. And for me, everyone else expands. Right? So there's nothing I don't know, because I am practically everything. Everything comes from me. Right? Krishna expands as Balaram. From Balaram, everything expands. Right? So therefore, he said to Krishna, he said, so what's going on? Because I can't understand what's happening, because I don't know what's going on here. So it means that you must be doing something. If I'm bewildered, you must be doing something. Right? So this shows that even Balaram can become bewildered by Krishna. So therefore, Krishna is supreme. This proves that Krishna is supreme out of all the incarnations. And Krishna said, yes, Brahma, I'm playing a trick on Brahma. Right? And in 3 days, the trick will end. Right? The pastime will finish. In another 3 days, the pastime will finish. Brahma will come back in about 3 days' time. Right? And you'll see that all the cowherd boys are still there and everything's still going on. Right? He thought he would bewilder me, but I've totally bewildered him. Right? And when he comes back, he'll understand everything. So in 3 days' time, Lord Brahma came back, right, which is only a moment in his time. But when he came back after one moment and he saw everything was the same, and he was totally confused. How is it that one moment ago I stole everyone, I put them in a cave, and then I came back and they're all there again? Right? And they looked back again, and then he looked back again, and everything was just the same. He was totally confused. So then Krishna, as the cowherd boys, all the cowherd boys turned into Lord Narayan. Right? All the cowherd boys developed four arms, right, and turned into Lord Narayan forms, all of them, and all the calves turned into Lord Narayan forms. And Lord Brahma was just, whoa, you know. He was totally bewildered. Brahma, Vimohan, Lila, Vimohan. Mohan means? Illusion, yeah, or bewildered, bewilderment, like that. Mohan. And Vimohan means? Means totally bewildered. Right? Super bewilderment, like just totally confused. Brahma, Vimohan, Lila. Brahma was just, you know, what did I just do? You know, who am I playing with? Right? Who am I trying to fool? Like that. So then in chapter 14, after chapter 13, Krishna bewilders Brahma. In chapter 14, then Lord Brahma comes to Krishna and he offers prayers. Right? So Krishna is just a cowherd boy. And Krishna is in the forest. Because you remember in chapter 13, in the pastime, Krishna was in the forest and all the calves wandered off into the distance. So then all the cowherd boys jumped up and they said, we have to find the calves. And Krishna said to everyone, you just keep having your picnic and I'll go off and I'll find the calves and you just keep having your lunch. So all the cowherd boys stayed there and then Krishna went off into the forest to find the calves. So then Lord Brahma came and he stole all the calves, he stole all the cowherd boys, and then he came back and Krishna had expanded himself. So then when Lord Brahma finally met Krishna after he'd been bewildered, he went looking for Krishna to apologize. And then he found Krishna within the forest. And Krishna was wandering around the forest looking for the calves. Right? And Lord Brahma is totally bewildered. You know, I've just been totally bewildered by Krishna, and now he's just, I find him and he's just walking around in the forest looking for the calves. As if he can't find the calves. Right? And Krishna had some yogurt in his left hand. Right? Normally, which hand do we eat with? As devotees, right hand, right? We never touch prasadam with the left hand, right? That's offensive to touch prasadam with your left hand. You always use the right hand, right? But Krishna's got yogurt in the left hand. So he's not even acting in a cultured way, right? So Lord Brahma has been totally bewildered, and then he's come to find Krishna and apologize, and Krishna's just walking around the forest with yogurt in the left hand looking for calves, right? And then in between his fingers, the acharyas described that he had his fingers together. And then in between his fingers, with his yogurt in his hand, in between the finger, like in between one finger, he had a piece of ginger. And in between another finger, I can't remember exactly what he had, but I think he had a chili. And in between another finger, he had a slice of lemon. So as he was taking his yogurt, he was mixing it with the different flavors. Like that. This is Krishna. Right? Totally enjoying, right? This is Vrindavan, right? Just totally unflustered by all of Lord Brahma's predicament. So Lord Brahma comes with four heads, right? Krishna's in Vrindavan as a little cowherd boy, only like 10 years old. And he comes into Vrindavan and he has four heads. And then he falls on the ground and offers dandavats, right? Which means like a rod. Dandavat means like a stick. So he falls down like a stick in front of Krishna with four heads, and then he stands up with folded hands and he begins to offer prayers to Krishna. And Krishna is looking at him, Like looking at this four-headed, right, opulent, powerful personality, and he's just sitting there eating his yogurt. He's just eating his yogurt, and then Lord Brahma begins to offer prayers in chapter 14. Like most eloquent, sophisticated, exalted Sanskrit prayers, defining Krishna as being the absolute truth. Right? We can't even hardly understand these prayers when we study them. They're so exalted, Lord Brahma's prayers. And Krishna's just sitting there, and he's looking at Lord Brahma, and he's just eating his yogurt. And Krishna's thinking, who's this person with the four heads? Like, what's going on? He's eating the yogurt. And Lord Brahma does a whole chapter of prayers, famous prayers, like most eloquent prayers. And at the end of it, Krishna just like looks at him and he just walks off. He's just like, who's this person? He just walks off. Doesn't even say anything. Doesn't even say thank you for your prayers. He just walks off. Just like goes off looking for the calves. Right? So this is his position. Right? So even Balaram becomes bewildered by Krishna's potency. That's how powerful Krishna is. So in this chapter, Rukmi is trying to bewilder Lord Balaram, which is very foolish, because if you think that you can outdo God, this means you are under the influence of Maya. What type of Maya?
Mahamaya.
Yeah, not Yoga Maya. Right? If you think you can outdo God, right, you're in big Maya. So here, Rukmi, he's rolling dice, and his friend said to him that play dice with Balaram because he's not very good at dice. You'll be able to make a lot of money. Right? So this is Rukmi, he's thinking yes. So he rolls the dice, he wins the first round, and then he shows all of his teeth to Balaram. He smiles at Balaram. Right? I've just beaten you. Right? And Balaram didn't like this. This is not the way to deal with the Lord. Right? It's like, Krishna is on the altar offering the chamra to Lord Balaram, and he's going, right? This is not the right mood. Right? The mood is incorrect. Right? So Balaram doesn't appreciate this. Krishna does not appreciate this. Prabhupada said, when you come before the deities, you must be in a very pleasant mood. You must be in the right mood. Right? You cannot be in a mood of disturbing the deities, disturbing Krishna. So Rukmi's mood was wrong. Right? So what did Balaram do? He killed him. He killed him. Right? If your mood is going to be incorrect towards the Lord, you will be chastised. Right? And that's how Krishna deals. Just like we see on the temple, we have decorated, we have lotus, club, disc and conch. Right? These are the four symbols of the Lord. Right? In his four hands, he holds these four symbols. Now, two of them are for the devotees and two of them are for the demons. Right? He keeps the lotus flower and the conch for the devotees. You'll see in the beginning, in the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, that when Krishna blew his conch, what was his conch's name? Panchajanya. Right? When he blew his conch at the beginning of the battle, in the first chapter of the Gita, all the devotees became inspired. Right? And when he shows you the lotus flower, sometimes you'll see he holds the lotus flower when he's giving benedictions to the devotees. This is the sign of mercy or benediction. This is what he keeps for his devotees. But for the demons, right, he shows them the chakra and the club. So Rukmi was disrespectful to Lord Balaram, so he got to see the chastising side of the Lord. So sometimes as devotees, if we act improperly, if we have the wrong mood towards the Lord, right, if we have like a demoniac mood towards the Lord, then Krishna will chastise us. He will show us the club. He'll give us some mercy to bring us back to our senses. But if we're in good consciousness, then we'll get the benediction. So here we see that Rukmi received the mercy of Lord Balaram, right, in a very powerful way, right, because he was disturbing Lord Balaram's pastimes. He did not have the correct mood towards Lord Balaram, so Lord Balaram chastised him very severely. He killed him like that. So we want to stay on the good side of Krishna. We want Krishna to always look at us positively. Right? Whenever we come before Krishna, we want Krishna to be smiling at us. Prabhupada says that the barometer of bhakti, or the way to one way to understand if your devotional service is going well, Prabhupada says the deities will be smiling at you. If you sometimes see the deities and they're not smiling, then that means you have to think very deeply, what am I doing or what have I done? Is my mood correct? Am I offering my service in the proper mood? Am I surrendering properly? Do I have the proper attitude when I do my service? Srila Prabhupada says in the beginning of the Nectar of Instruction, he says that devotional service, advancement in devotional service in spiritual life, depends upon the attitude of the performer. Right? All of our advancement in Krishna consciousness depends on our attitude. That's all it is. The most advanced devotees have the best attitude. Now that's why they're advanced devotees, because their attitude is right towards Krishna. Right? They have proper bhakti or proper devotion towards Krishna. But if one does not have proper devotion towards Krishna, if one's attitude is not correct when one's doing one's service, if one is alloyed or mixed, if there's Mishra bhakti means mixed devotion. That means when you're doing your service, if it's mixed with other motives or other things, then it's not so pleasing to Krishna. Just like if one is proud, right? One is doing one's service, but one has pride mixed with the service, it is not so pleasing to Krishna. If one is greedy, and one is doing one's service, but it's based on greed or getting something in return from Krishna, it's not pleasing for Krishna. If one has lust, right? One is doing one's service, but some lust is within one's consciousness, it is not so pleasing to Krishna. If one is angry, right? One is doing one's service, but one is angry towards Krishna, resentful towards Krishna. Krishna, why do I have to do this service? Right? Then it is not so pleasing to Krishna. So therefore, we have to have the correct attitude. And if you have the correct attitude, then you get blessed by Krishna. Krishna reciprocates. Yayatam mam prapajyante tam stataiva bhajamyaham. As you surrender to me, if your attitude is correct, I will reward you accordingly. Yeah? That is Krishna's. So here we see that Rukmini's mood was not correct. So then Lord Balaram had to deal with him appropriately. So we'll stop here and we'll see if there's any questions or comments on what we discussed.
So what do you say to someone when they think they know the Bhagavad Gita but they don't know the Bhagavad Gita, like on book distribution? What would you say to someone when you find out that they don't actually know the Bhagavad Gita? How do you persuade them to study more?
There's like two different parts, right? One is how do you deal with someone when they don't actually understand the Gita, and the other part is how do you encourage them to like that. So obviously there's different ways you can deal with every circumstance like that. But sometimes people say, like they say, oh, you know, Krishna says this in the Bhagavad Gita, or the Bhagavad Gita says this, or first point is you have to know the Bhagavad Gita. First point. Do you know the Bhagavad Gita? That's the first point. Like Prabhupada, I think he was up here in his room in Melbourne, and it's different conversations you see, and Prabhupada's explaining this point. Prabhupada says these books are not just for distributing, they are for reading, like that. And then Prabhupada was imitating one of his disciples who was a book distributor, and Prabhupada was saying, take this book, take this book. And the person was saying, what is in the book? And Prabhupada says, it doesn't matter what's in the book, just take it. So sometimes it's like that. You know, we try to give the Bhagavad Gita to someone, or we're trying to preach to someone, distribute books to someone. We don't even know what's in the book. We haven't even read the book. Just take it. It's good for you. What's in it? I don't know. Just read it. It's good. How do you know it's good? Because the food's good. Right? Because I've been in the temple. The food's good. You know, devotees are nice, so therefore the book's good. Right? It's not enough like that. So the point is that you have to know the Bhagavad Gita like that. I remember when a few years back, when about 10 years ago, when book distribution was very strong in Europe, and there were some very famous book distributors, Hari Namananda Prabhu and Navina Narada Prabhu. These were the very famous book distributors. And Hari Namananda Prabhu set the world record for distributing books on the street in one day. 969 books. And this is hardback books. There's hardback books, like, you know, SSRs and Gitas and like hardback, not like soft, not small books. You know, 969 hardback books and one day on the street, right? Devotees have done more books than that in factories and things. You know, they went into a factory and the boss brought, you know, 1,000 and gave them all to the workers. But on the street, all day, in one marathon, did 969. Now, Harinamananda Prabhu had read all of Prabhupada's books, and meant the whole Bhagavatam, the whole Chaitanya Charitamrita, the Gita, teachings of Lord Chaitanya, like everything, nectar, all the small books, everything. At about that point, he'd read all of Prabhupada's books about seven times. And whenever you asked him, like, where was your empowerment coming from? You know, how were you empowered to distribute so many books? He said, because I read the books. And he was reading the books 3 or 4 hours every day. Right? And then most days he'd go out on book distribution for about 3 hours. And while in that 3 hours, on average, every day, he would distribute 100 hardback books in 3 hours. And then the rest of the day, he would spend like 3 or 4 hours a day reading Prabhupada's books. Right? So he knew the books so well. And he would go onto the street and he would have like the Srimad Bhagavatam. And he would distribute, like he'd give someone the fifth canto. And when he gave them the book, if you know, because he'd just have a pile of books, he'd just go to the van, just pick up a whole pile of books. He wouldn't even look at like which book he was getting. Just pick up the whole pile of books, go out on the street and just start distributing. And when he gave someone a book, if he gave them the fifth canto, he could tell them exactly what was in the fifth canto, because he knew. Right? And then if he gave them the third canto, he could say, yes, and this is exactly what's in the third canto. And then he would ask them questions. He would say to them, what are you interested in? You're interested in philosophy or history or geography, or what are you into? And a person would say, oh, I'm into this or that. And then he'd say, yes, in this book, there is this subject and it relates to what you're interested in. That's how well he knew the books. So Prabhupada said we should know his books like lawyers know the law books, or like Christians know the Bible. Right? You ever meet the Christians on the street? They know the Bible. Right? They say Psalms, you know, 112, or they say John 6:14, or you know, they know the Bible. We should know the Bhagavad Gita like that. So we go onto the street and someone says, yeah, I know the Bhagavad Gita, so what do you know about the Bhagavad Gita? And then usually they'll say some speculation, usually. You say, where is that in the Bhagavad Gita? Right? And then you teach them what's actually in the Bhagavad Gita. You say, Krishna says in chapter 2, right, verse 72 or whatever you're quoting. And then you say, this is what Krishna actually says. And then you try to convince them. Right? And usually I say to people that, you know, if you're going to say all these things, like Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, then please read the Bhagavad Gita. At least read it and actually know what he says, and then you can say something. Don't just say something if you don't actually know. Well, sometimes people, you know, they challenge our philosophy. I say, have you read the Srimad Bhagavatam? Right, have you read it? And they'll say, no. I say, okay, you go and you read 18,000 verses and then you come back and we'll talk. Right? But otherwise don't say, oh, you know, don't criticize our philosophy, or don't challenge our philosophy until you've studied our philosophy. Because when you study it deeply, you'll see it is a wonderful philosophy. So at least have some knowledge about it before you criticize. I don't know if that helps, but...
On the same point, what you said, if you approach an Indian fellow, mostly on the street, ask him, do you know who he is? I know who he is. He might not even know one word. And he'll say, you know that he knows who he is. Looks like an expert.
I think the only thing they do know is Bhagavad Gita would take away their sense gratification.
Yeah.
That's why they're just like, no. Get back!
Yeah, it's true. One of Krishna's names is Hari. Hari means one who takes everything away. That's why people like to worship Shiva. Because Shiva is Ashutosh, which means he's easily pleased. So when you worship Shiva, he'll give you... And Prabhupada says in the Krishna book, the worshippers of Shiva are usually rich, but the worshippers of Krishna are usually poor. Right? You see, devotees aren't usually wealthy. Usually. I mean, some devotees are wealthy, but usually you see devotees aren't so wealthy because Krishna takes away the material opulence. Because if you have too much material opulence, Queen Kunti says, Janmaishwaya Shruta Shribiya. If you have too much material opulence, it distracts you from Krishna consciousness. So see, generally, Krishna will give the devotees just enough. Right, give them enough to maintain themselves comfortably, but he won't give them too much usually because they'll become distracted. Like that. But you see, the worshippers of Lord Shiva, they might be very rich because they want wealth. Lord Shiva says, okay, take it. But Krishna won't, he doesn't act like that. So, any other question or comment?
From all of this, it's obvious that the Lord is the source of everything, of all incarnations, and he is infinite and wonderful. But what if you meet people who don't know Shastras? You've backed everything up with Shastras, and it's been fascinating, and I love it, that what you said to someone, you know, who has extremely fine logic, who won't accept that God is the original candle, they'd say, who is the original candle? Come on, that's not a good allegory. And something infinite can't be the origin of everything, you know, and well, yes, the Lord is the sun of, you know, the sun is one of the Lord's eyes, and energy and the energetic. So, if you weren't able to, even if you could back it up our shastras, what is the other allegory you could give them, analogy? I mean, because some of these are so simple but can't be accepted by people.
Yeah. When you preach to someone, you can only take it as far as the person's willing to accept it or listen. Like that. I mean, like the saying is there, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. So when you preach to someone, you can try to convince them, but it's up to them whether or not they accept. And if they want to challenge God's supremacy or his authority, then they'll do that regardless. Just like Prabhupada gives the example of scissors. Right? The two men are arguing. One man throws the other man off the bridge. And as he's going down, he's still saying, scissors, 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 like that. So some people, Prabhupada says, it doesn't matter what you say, then they'll still keep saying that, no, there isn't a God. So we can use logic. You know, there's logic. Sometimes we use Shastra, sometimes we use logic to try to convince people. But it's up to them whether they want to accept. Our philosophy is definitely logical. It's not an illogical philosophy. If it was illogical, I wouldn't be following it. No, it's not illogical. It's a logical philosophy. Obviously, it deals with things which are super powerful and super mundane, so therefore there are certain elements of it which require faith, like that. So it's not all based on, you know, you can't prove it empirically that it all happens. But still, it is a logical philosophy. So by Shastra or logic, we try to preach to people whatever it takes, and if they accept, that's up to them. Is that okay?
I would like to know chronological order of when Ramayana happened, Mahabharata, and when Srila Vyasa wrote scriptures, and then Kali Yuga started. Chronological order. When it happened.
So you have four yugas, right? Satya, Treta, Dwapara, Kali. Four yugas. So at the end of Treta Yuga, the second yuga, at the end of that yuga, that's when Lord Ram appears. And Lord Ram stays on earth for 11,000 years. Right? At the end of Treta Yuga. Like that. And then Mahabharata takes place at the end of Dwapara Yuga, just before Kali Yuga begins. And that's when Srila Vyasadeva writes down the Vedas at the end of Dwapara Yuga, just before Kali Yuga begins.
So after the battle, Kurukshetra battle finished, after that he wrote?
Yeah, around about that time, yeah. Because that happened at the end of Kali Yuga, and so did the time when Lord Srila Vyasadeva wrote the Vedas. Is that what you wanted? Yeah. Any other question or comment? Okay, Srila Prabhupada ki.
Yeah.